morning, everybody, and welcome back to our next day of the Fatherland Conversation. I hope you've all had a wonderful night's sleep and a fresh and layering to go. Okay. So I'm going to hand you straight over to Bob Stone. Bob, as many of you will know, is a former chairman of the Philosophical Society, and he's going to be telling us why Kant got it a bit wrong about moral responsibility.
Right. I'm starting off by referring to Kant, partly because a bit of name dropping lends a touch of class to any talk, but also because he identifies the central problem that I'm talking about in this talk, namely the apparent inconsistency between the philosophical idea that everything is caused by what went before. And the assumption in ordinary life that people are, in general, free to choose between options and therefore answerable for the choices they make. Now, first I'll talk about causal determinism, and then about our feeling of accountability, and finally the relation between those two ideas. Right. As many of you will know, Kant speaks of two worlds. There is the world of things in themselves, things as they really are, which are beyond our grasp. What we have access to is the other world, the world of appearances, things as they appear to us. And in this latter world, the world of appearances, the world we study as well, things appear to us not just as raw sensations, but as organized under various concepts. Not merely learned concepts like chair, stage, lectern, but 12 general categories that are hardwired into us, not his metaphor. We cannot help seeing the world as consisting, for instance, of substances, roughly speaking, things. And in particular, for our purposes, as part of a system of cause and effect, causality being one of the 12 categories. Whether we like it or not, we see everything as caused by something else, according to natural laws of necessity. Now, Kant applies this all-embracing causality to human behaviour too. However much we may distinguish between those actions we perform freely and those we are forced to perform, they are all the result of what happened previously, either inside ourselves or in the outside world. At one point he's discussing the idea that in the case of a theft, it is simultaneously true that the thief is acting freely, that is, not under duress, and that his theft is entirely the result of antecedent causes. In a famous passage in the Critique of Practical Reason, he says, "It is a wretched subterfuge to seek to evade this by," and I paraphrase, "distinguishing between determining causes lying within the thief and those lying outside him. They are still determining causes. One might," he says, "choose to use the term psychological freedom to distinguish actions that are caused entirely by things going on in the mind from those caused by external forces. But those things going on in the mind are themselves caused by things that went on in the mind earlier," etc., etc., backwards ad infinitum. They're not quite infinitum, actually. Big Bang, I suppose. "There is no transcendental freedom, i.e., exemption from the natural laws of necessity. Everything is causally determined." Now, before I move on to Kant's view of where this leaves morality and responsibility, I should add that I believe he is absolutely spot on so far. He does admittedly ignore the possibility that some things in our world of appearances happen at random. Now, for all I know, they may. Quantum mechanics seems to have discovered randomness at the level of tiny particles, though this is disputed. even if that randomness is said not to spill over significantly into the middle-sized world. I really don't know whether randomness, I'm not qualified to judge, but I don't think it makes any difference to the argument, except to enlarge it somewhat. Anything that happens at any level of the world is either determined by what went before, or it happens at random. And that includes human actions and intentions and thoughts. My slide, a little bit late, of randomness. Now, there are three words beginning with P, which seem to me to muddy the waters. So I just wanted to get those out of the way. Some claim that the past makes it overwhelmingly probable, let's say 90% likely, that I will decide to act in a certain way. But that there's a kind of leeway in which I can, as a free agent, choose whether to decide in that way or in another. Now the question then arises, or should arise, what explains my choosing the 90% option rather than one of the options within the 10% improbable range? There are only two possible answers. Either the past history of my mind and the world pushes me irresistibly in the direction of the 90% option, or one of the others, in which case there was no leeway, but pure determinism. Or my decision between the options was uncaused, and so happened at random. The idea that as a free agent, I am somehow exempt from the logic of causal determinism or randomness, seems to me another example of a wretched subterfuge. A second P word is physical. None of what I have said depends on one's holding a physicalist view of human behaviour and thinking. Forget everything that's been discovered about brains and neurons. Be a Cartesian dualist. It is still an inescapable fact that an event, whether a thought, a decision, or an action, is either causally determined by what went before, or it happens at random. That would be true even if thinking consisted of pure spirit in corporeal mind. And the third irrelevant word beginning with P is predictability. If every decision of mine is determined by what went before, then I suppose some perfectly knowledgeable being outside the universe and incapable of interfering with it, like God, for instance, would be able to predict it. But the chances of a precise prediction are zero for human beings, and probably always will be, probably, because the sheer number of variables, 80 billion neurons, the last time I read it, and trillions of possible connections between them, changing every moment, will make that well nigh impossible. So don't worry about your determined decisions being even more predictable than they mostly are already. Predictability is not a consequence of determinism, and more important, for my purposes, unpredictability does not imply indeterminism. Finally, to those who suggest that it is reasons that prompt my actions rather than causes, as if these are somehow mutually exclusive, I would reply that, of course, in many decisions I make, reasons, both for and against, enter into the preceding causal mix. But these are simply factors among many others, such as upbringing, mood, memories, temperament, circumstances, that together constitute the cause of my behaviour, my decision. I may use reasons to justify my decision after the event, but when we discuss what reason someone had for making a certain decision, we're not usually discussing the factual question of how the decision arose, but the logical question of, or practical question, of whether the decision was justified by evidence and reason, of which more later. Now, where does that leave us with regard to morality and responsibility? At first sight, nowhere. We may develop a clear idea of what is right and wrong, as Kant himself did, but the words right and wrong seem rather pointless if everything I do is determined by what went before. There's no point in blaming me for mugging the old lady if my decision to do so was determined by the whole history of the universe up to that point. All praise and blame of others, all shame and guilt on our own account, would be unjustified and futile. Everyone's defence in court would be the same. Sorry, my love, but the old history of the universe made me do it. Putting on a working class accent just to show the sort of people we get in court. Notice the signifier there. We do sometimes attribute our own actions, or beliefs from years ago, which we now disapprove, to our upbringing environment. And we even feel sympathy for those convicted of crimes we would never even think of committing, wanting to commit, if we think they've been influenced by an unfortunate background. But the logic of this argument is that every human action is determined. It is not only people I see as less fortunate than me, or I myself in the past, who should be exonerated from censure, or indeed praise, but everyone equally. The poor criminal who burgles houses for a living, the rich philanthropist who gives most of his money to good causes, and I, somewhere in between, are equally doing what we're doing because all the circumstances of our lives, our environment, and the universe have combined to make us do it. No one, absolutely no one, deserves praise or blame for anything they do. Now, the problem is, but however irresistible that conclusion is, and it is irresistible, believe me, no one seems to take any notice of it in everyday life. Even those of us who are quite convinced that all human behaviour is causally determined, nonetheless expect ourselves and others to be accountable for our actions and to deserve praise and blame for them. If, instead of attacking my talk afterwards and arguing with me, someone told me it was just what anyone from my background would say, I should be furious and ask them to step outside the nearest nightclub. We do, in fact, make a distinction between that vast majority of human beings whom we treat as morally responsible for their behaviour and those few who do not have the mental capacity to understand what moral responsibility means. One of the best criteria I've seen is that of Fischer and Ravitsa, who argue that a morally responsible person is one who accepts that he is a fair target of the reactive attitudes, that's praise and blame, as a result of how he exercises his agency in certain contexts, that is, when he's not under compulsion. And in another place, an agent is morally responsible for an action insofar as it issues from his own moderately reasons-responsive mechanism. So most of us are capable of acting on the basis of reasons rather than just irresistible impulses. And we accept that we deserve praise or blame when we do things voluntarily. The Fischer-Ravitsa definition may need some tweaking. And there are, of course, fuzzy areas where it's not clear whether some people fall within it. For example, people with some serious addictions, or psychopaths. And there are degrees of responsibility. For example, children do not suddenly wake up one morning at the accountability stage. And some addictions may have different degrees of resistibility. But whatever criteria we may use to decide who is to be held accountable and who not, the issue has nothing to do, whatever to do, with the philosophical problem that all our actions, however accountable they may be, are causally determined, and so in some more ultimate sense are beyond praise or blame. So how can I simultaneously believe that everyone's actions are causally determined, and feel guilty when I've done something wrong, and indignant when somebody else does? Is this simply dishonesty, self-deception, or, as the polite expression nowadays, cognitive dissonance? Well, one response to this bleak landscape might be to want to deny one half of the premise, the argument that everything is determined, or possibly random. If I were to do that, it really would be dishonest, or as Kant puts it, a wretched subterfuge. So let's see how Kant deals with this weakness. He maintains that all this stuff about causes and determinism is a feature of the world of appearances, the world that we ourselves apprehend and which science investigates. Behind the appearances is the world of things in themselves, of which we can have no knowledge. So the real world may not have categories such as causation. Now, given that according to Kant we seem to ourselves to be free and to be capable of doing right and wrong, it must be that each of us is in some sense two people. In the world of appearances, we are objects in the natural world, all our actions caused by the past, according to the laws of nature. But in the world of things in themselves, we are free from the laws of nature, though subject to the equally inexorable laws of reason, where right and wrong are meaningful, and praise and blame make sense. Now, to my mind, this approach is a non-starter, and if I had another half an hour, I'd argue fully about it. But it does suggest an alternative approach, which I think is much more fruitful. There is indeed a sense. Yes, there is indeed a sense in which we do see the world in two different ways. Not two different worlds, but the same world approached from different angles. There's the world as the sciences, or we as spectators, try to see it. Something to be observed, its rules worked out, whether in the area of physics, economics, psychology, or any other science. But it's also a place to be in, to do things in, to cope with, where the priority is not to come up with a true description of the event we can see unfolding, but to stop it happening because it's dreadful. The point is not to interpret the world, but to change it, as I used to see written over the walls at the university. And that is probably how most of us see the world for about 95% of the time. Let me say, random slide here, let me say something about the world we experience as something we are in. For one thing, the idea of seeing the world purely as an observer, a spectator, is practically impossible, or something we're able to do only after taking artificial leave of the actual world. It may seem at first sight that when we perceive things, we register everything in our field of vision, like a camera, we choose what we want to focus on, and then we decide how to evaluate what we're observing. That may give the impression that the function of perception is to give us objective knowledge. That is simply not how it works. What we observe does not merely come ready sorted under cognitive concepts, whether Kantian general categories or more specific learnt ones. The brain has already selected the elements that interest it and fitted them into an existing evaluative pattern before we are consciously aware of what's going on. The choice of what to notice depends on the brain's expectations, which are formed by our past history. And the evaluation depends on our similarly developed evaluative landscape, to use Peter Railton's phrase. He spoke here in May, and I'm using one of his pictures. Every new perception thus filtered may change our expectations, our evaluative landscape, in a constant process of feedback. Now, according to Matthew Ratcliffe, another philosopher, we each have a structured experiential world, which governs not only how we perceive and react emotionally to what is around us, but also controls how we reason, in a practical sense, about what we're going to do. And a disturbing experience may well change the structure of that experiential world and our ways of reasoning about things. One important consideration here is that information from our senses does not enter straight into the higher intellectual areas of the brain, at least not in normal people in normal circumstances. The information goes first to the affective areas of the brain, thus giving us a feel for the content before we're even conscious of what we're perceiving. This feel is very interesting, and to take a specific and highly important example, when we perceive other people, we can generally tell by some kind of intuition what they are feeling using our natural sensitivity to body language and other cues. The way this works, I'm told by researchers at Sussex University, is this. The perceived cues, having entered our brain through the eyes, or wherever, are transmitted first to the amygdala, one of the affective areas of the brain, which transmits the information in turn to the relevant bodily parts associated with emotion. Our body is thus affected with the emotion, for instance, increased heart rate, sweating, and other changes relevant to the particular emotion we're looking at. Only then is that information about the body transmitted to the higher cortical areas of the brain, where we become consciously aware of the emotions that our body is experiencing, and which, by inference, the person we're looking at is experiencing too. That is empathy. And in the case of those with very severe autism, which is what the Sussex University is researching on, everything seems to work normally up to that last stage, called by the technical term interoception, where the brain knows what's going on in the body. In fact, seriously autistic people, when observing others, feel in their bodies, as measured by the usual physical tests, more intense emotions than those who are not autistic. But the information is not then sent to the higher areas of the brain, which means that the severely autistic person does not realise what his or her body is feeling, and so has little idea of what the other person is feeling either. And finally, on this topic of how we experience the world, while the particular evaluative system that each of us has may owe a great deal to our environment and upbringing and so on, it does seem that we have some kind of evaluative system, especially a morally evaluating one, from a very early age. The now well-known research, which is ongoing, by the Canadian Kylie Hamlin in her frighteningly named baby lab at the University of British Columbia, shows that most babies under the age of one already have moral attitudes. She shows them puppet dramas where some puppets are being helpful to puppets trying to do something, such as open a box, and other puppets are hindering them. At 5 months old, most babies prefer, that is, reach out smilingly to me, that kind of thing, roughly. They prefer the helpful puppets to the hindering ones. And at eight months old, most babies not only prefer helpers to hinderers, but favour those puppets who punish rather than help the hinderers. Now, whatever the problems of deriving conclusions from this kind of evidence, and they are quite large, it does show pretty conclusively, I think, that the babies have already developed an evaluative attitude to the behaviour they see around them. And their evaluation can be based, doesn't have to be, but can be based on morally relevant features. Now, you may be wondering, this is all jolly interesting, maybe even true, but what does it have to do with causation and responsibility? Well, it's to demonstrate the point I'm making about our engagement with the world. We are not designed or evolved to be spectators of life or of the universe. We're designed, just like animals, to take part in the world and cope with it. And even if, unlike most animals, probably, we are able to sit back from time to time and reflect on the world as if from outside, or at least try to, and to conclude, for example, that everything is causally determined, we cannot help feeling quite different when we're actually making decisions and doing things in the world. It's a fundamental feature of our minds that we automatically, pre-consciously, see our world as full of desirable and undesirable things. We make evaluative and moral judgments about it. Faced with a situation in which there's more than one course of action open to us, we feel we can choose how to behave. And finally, we hold ourselves and expect others to hold us accountable for our choices. Now, here's a very specific example of the absolute necessity of keeping these two attitudes to the world conceptually separate. Phil the philosopher, a character borrowed from the thought experiment by Alfred Mealy, has concluded that all human behaviour is determined, and therefore he is not responsible for any of his actions. Now, whether he's right or wrong in that opinion, it's interesting to speculate what happens when he is confronted with a conventional moral problem. The secret police knock at his door and ask him whether he has any illegal immigrants hiding in the house. He has, but he knows that to tell the truth, a good thing, would mean almost certain death for the immigrants, a bad thing. So, does he tell the truth, or does he save the immigrants? Now, we spectators, thinking about his dilemma from a safe distance, may think, rightly, that his decision will depend on certain facts about his upbringing, his mood, the sort of person he is, a host of other factors. But to Phil, who has to make the decision, such thoughts, if he had them, would be quite useless. He may be a philosopher, but unless he's some kind of freak, he will not wonder to himself what his decision is likely to be given his upbringing, circumstances, etc. And if he did, and concluded he would be likely to tell the truth, would he then tell the truth on the ground that he was inevitably going to anyway? It's clear that this way of thinking about what you're going to do is not only useless for reaching a decision, but also it's impossible to imagine actually indulging in it. What would actually happen, probably, is that reasons on both sides of the argument would occur to him, and depending on his personality, mood and so on, he would find one set of reasons more powerful than the other and act on it. Deciding what to do here and now, and explaining how we or others came to make a decision at some point in the past, or might make a decision in the future, are two utterly different things. Let me put this distinction, to continue the name-dropping theme, in Wittgensteinian terms. Or was it Wittgensteinian? I don't know. Anyway, in terms that Wittgenstein would like. There are two different language games being played here, each with its appropriate style of discourse. There is the game which scientists play, and which we all play as spectators of the world, and there is the game which we all play as participants in the world. According to the spectator view, everything that happens is fully determined, possibly with an admixture of randomness, whereas in the participant view, we choose to do various good and bad things, often for reasons. We are accountable for our choices, we acknowledge that we deserve blame for our bad choices, and we dish it out to others. The attempt to find compatibility between these two ways of approaching the world is misguided, since they are different discourses, different language games, which are played in different circumstances. Now, Merleau-Ponty, my second to last name drop, says in the introduction to his Phenomenology of Perception that, and I quote, the first rule of phenomenology is first and foremost the disavowal of science. I am not the result of the intertwining of multiple causalities that determine my body or my psyche. I cannot think of myself as part of the world, like the simple object of biology, psychology, and sociology. Now, I suggest that he's not necessarily in denial about science and determinism. Well, he needn't be, he is actually, but he needn't be. He could be claiming that their discourse is inappropriate for being in, acting in, and experiencing the world. I suppose one of the ways in which the two approaches could meet is this. The scientific observer, social scientists say, in order to get a true, objective picture of the world, must take into account, as an observed fact, that one of the many factors that constitute the determining cause of human behaviour is the feeling each of us has that we have various options open to us and that we can be held to account for our choices. If that were not so, our behaviour would probably be very different and very odd. Now, to conclude with a soundbite, rather than our being, in the words of Sartre, my final name drop, condemned to be free, all our thoughts and actions are causally determined, but we are condemned to see ourselves as free to choose, and we are condemned to feel accountable for our choices. Condemned, that is, or maybe privileged, depending on your degree of enthusiasm for life. End of.
Thank you very much. What struck me particularly about this approach is the making of moral judgments as something quite different from any other sort of judgment, and I wonder if this is valid or useful. I get an essay from a student. I notice that he can't spell very well, and I suggest an appropriate remedy to get him to spell better, perhaps using spell better. I notice that here, there, and elsewhere, the logical sequence of his thoughts is disordered. So again, I recommend an appropriate correction. And then I find that the whole thing was plagiarized anyway. And once again, I take what I take assume to be appropriate corrective action to ensure that this doesn't happen again. What's the special bit about the last one that makes it different from any of the others?
Off the top of my head, I've no idea. I would just make a distinction between describing what happened, he did this, that, and the other, and doing something about it. Whether it's a question of moral correction or spelling correction, I wouldn't. Well, I mean, if I had time to think about it, I might be able to work out a distinction between moral and any other kind of doing. But it's the fact that you're trying to intervene in the world, which is a different discourse from trying to describe the world. I wouldn't go overboard about the moral. The artistic judgments would be the same, I think. That's all I would say. That sounds like a get-out answer. Best I can do.
Thank you. Can I first say, please, I agree with a lot of what you said. I wasn't expecting
but,
to say so
much. But.
I think what you did describe earlier was this combination in the world of determinism and random effects. And what we have as human beings is what I would call reflectivity. We have the ability to stand back and review things and improve things. So we're not just being beaten up as we go along, we're actually saying, if we do this, we do that, we can make things better. And that gives another dimension. And just to go back to Kant, I would say that his thing in itself, the way I always treat that, is, yes, of course, appearances may not be everything. It does not get to describe everything. They're what our senses take in, what we make of those senses. And there might be something beyond that. And that's how I would see being yourself. It's to push us to think there's more to the world than what's coming to our eyes, whatever it is.
Okay, I'll leave the Kant discussion for later, because that could take all day. But the first point about reflection. I'll tell you a little story. About 55 years ago, there was a boy at school in the same boarding house as me, and he was always reading philosophy, which didn't interest me then. And he was trying to persuade me that everything was determined, that we didn't have any free will. And I, of course, said, that's stupid. Of course we do. I know I have. I can feel it. And then one day he came along and said to me, actually, I've been reading something else. And we have, as David said, we have the power of reflection, which animals don't have. So I think perhaps we do have free will because we can think about it. And I said, being an argumentative so-and-so at the time, I said, but surely reflection does like anything else, that my thoughts, the thoughts that I have reflecting on them, on the world, are just as likely to be determined as my falling off the stage if somebody pushes me. I mean, why do I reflect this way rather than that way? I said it as an ad hominem argument, little realising that about 55 years later, or 30 years probably later, I would realise that what I was saying was absolutely true. And I still think that reflection is just like anything else. What the course of my thoughts when I'm reflecting, it doesn't just happen at random, it's caused by what went before, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's what I would say. It's just another bit of the determined world.
Paul. Yes, interesting talk indeed. Wittgenstein interests me. There seem to be two minds that one person can have, the spectator. Well, it's one person who has the potential for both these thoughts, and then the doer, who has to live the lives we have to live, as Homo sapiens. As philosophers, we're all attempting to be philosophers, I think, well, perhaps we should take the spectator observation of the universe and apply that to our ethics. I mean, I do try and do that sometimes. I say, well, I thought about this issue. I'm not going to be, as Hume says, you know, reason's going to be the slave of the passions. I'm going to make reason my prime motivation. I mean, it's a bit like the Pauline warning of the spirit and flesh, I think, in a more religious thing. It seems there is a battle going on in the mind of the person, certainly the thinking person. Am I right in picking up on that? Which way you should go, I'm not sure, but I would actually favour thinking about the issues and saying, well, yes, I know I've got to do something, but actually I would rather be motivated by my thoughts. And you haven't mentioned categorical imperative, but surely Kant was very much in favour of that. Do not lie as an absolute. And the motivation has to be doing a good work is not good enough. He has to have the motivation behind it. Philosophically, I'd rather favour thinking of the issue and working it out. Now, that isn't always going to obtain because you have to make split second decisions.
Yeah. Okay.
But am I going down an area which you have, well, I'm sure you have thought about it.
Right. I don't. There are occasions when it's obviously right to try and think objectively about the way things are, and there are occasions when you've just got to decide what you're going to do on the spur of the moment, and those are clearly different occasions. But I think I can see what you mean. It's possible you want to stand back and think about what's right and wrong, and that's a reflective attitude, which you can take from time to time. But what I do think, I think I'm really perhaps answering a question you didn't ask, but I thought somebody probably would. When I said you have to keep these attitudes separate, I mean conceptually separate. The very fact that you're trying to consider your moral position, work out if it's a good one, is itself something you do. It's an action in the world. It's actually rather difficult to talk about the completely objective viewpoint of somebody, because even just saying that and trying to get it is itself an action in the world. So those two, and that's a point Merleau-Ponty makes on the next page after that quotation, that science thinks it's objective, but actually it's all done from our point of view. So it's tricky. And also, when I'm deciding, for instance, yesterday, how am I going to get from Oxford to Nottingham by car this evening? That's a doing thing. But on the other hand, within that, there is that little reflective bit where I have a look and see what roads there are between here and Oxford, and try and work out what the quickest way is to get there, assuming I want the quickest way. So there is a bit of reflective observing the world within the general decision of how to get to Nottingham. So the two things are not, I think, particularly in competition. They're complementary. But when you're actually making a decision about doing something, that's not the same thing I'm saying as wondering later what made you do it, or wondering in advance what's going to make you do it tomorrow. I just think those are two, just conceptually, I'll put in that word overnight, conceptually different things.
I disagree. I am thinking as much as I've got time to do it, and why am I doing this? Would I reflect on that tomorrow? Could I stand up in a court of law and say, yes, I justify my thoughts? I don't think like that when I have the opportunity.
I think that's all doing in the being in the world. You could think to yourself,
well, it's objectively thinking. I mean, you said, is the second thought doing without being objective? And that's my rule, the number of my questions.
If you care that much about justifying your actions, then that's acting in the world, I think.
Yeah, I don't think I separate them as much as you.
Can we move on to another question? David, please.
just to add to that slightly, I just wondered if you mentioned making decisions, Bob, and my question about that is to whether we simply experience having made a decision, but actually the moment of making the decision is removed from our consciousness. It's a bit like knowing, being conscious of when you fall asleep. And it's part of your final point about the phenomenology of us experiencing living in the world involves those aspects which we are required to do with morals and free will, which we have an understanding of, which is limited. The nature of decision making, I don't think, is what I think it is.
Yes, there have been occasions when I have decided to do something, and later, 5 minutes later, I've realised that my motive for doing it was not actually the argument I was thinking of at the time, but the desire to impress some nice-looking woman who was standing nearby, or something like that. So I think, in a sense, that it's difficult to find a moment of decision apart from actually doing it. And also you can decide to do something and change your mind, so the decision doesn't actually lead to the action. It's a difficult area. I don't think it affects my argument, but it's an interesting question in its own right. What exactly is going on when I decided, for instance, not to come by train and go home again tonight, but to come by car, drive to Nottingham tomorrow and watch the test match? Now, I don't remember a moment when I said, right, I'm going to do that. But there were moments before, times before, when I wondered if I would. And there were times when I knew perfectly well that's what I was going to do, that's what I had to do. I don't remember actually making a decision, because I didn't have to. Nobody said to me, oh, come on, tell me, Bob, are you going to Nottingham on Monday or not? So, in some ways, the actual making of the decision is a nebulous area. I agree with that implication.
Tim.
Hi, Rachel. I was intrigued why you dismissed Kant so quickly, and I won't get too detailed into Kant as such, but part of the reason I was intrigued was that his distinction between appearances and the world as it is in reality seemed entirely analogous to your distinction between spectator and doer. So I kind of thought, well, surely you can, you're seeing that tension, or you're seeing that distinction. So why are you dismissing that? And I wondered whether, is it because you are taking as a given the doctrine of determinism? Because I don't believe I heard you argue for determinism against simply, well, that's how the world is. And I wouldn't, and then reflecting on the other talk yesterday, I think perhaps virtually everybody is taking determinism as a given. So I suppose what I'd like you to consider, or at least respond to, is it actually possible that the world is not deterministic? That, to use Peter Van Inwagen's definition, is that I could have done otherwise. So that I'm actually not wasting my time when I'm pondering on a decision, because there is a real choice to be made. And that I could do one thing, I could genuinely do another.
No, basically. I mean, to my mind, it's just a logical matter that either something that happens is determined, or it happens at random, perhaps from within a determined parameter or something. I can't see any alternative to that that makes any logical sense at all. So it's not that I've examined the world and found it's deterministic. Although if you reduce things to things like billiard tables, where you take away as many variables as you can, it looks pretty deterministic. But of course, there's quantum mechanics. If only that hadn't been invented. that's a matter of randomness. I can't see any other alternative. But when people say, "Well, perhaps I can decide to do something," that's not. It's saying anything more than a volcano can erupt. That's not causation. Of course it is. If I decide to do something, the question arises, why did I decide to do it? Why did I think like that? Why did I decide like that? Any question you like, any event, must either have been caused or it happened at random.
So are we wasting our time when we try to make a decision? And if we are, how have we evolved to a point where we are wasting so much of our time getting on doing it?
Well, because if we didn't, we wouldn't have evolved at all, I suppose. We have to think like that in order to get anywhere. No, I don't. I'm trying to say that the two things are not actually incoherent. At least the determinism seems to me indeterminism, in the sense of something other than determinism or randomness, seems to me incoherent, doesn't make any sense at all. What I'm trying to do is fit in to that, which I take as a given, as you put it, to fit into that the fact that we feel this idea of how to choose things. And I'm trying to put it into the idea of a different discourse. I'm not sure how convincing that is, but it's my attempt. I think Kant's attempt to put this world of things in themselves gives it a sort of higher status. Given that the world of things in ourselves is something we can know nothing about, I always wonder how he can then know that world has free will in it, and morals, and God, and immortality, and all those other things he wants desperately to believe in, but is honest enough to realise you can't prove from the world of appearances. So I'm a little bit cynical about that view of Kant.
And I'm afraid that's all we've got time for now, so can we...